Acts 4, verse 17 is where we've left off today and where we begin. Still thinking about the Sanhedrin. Peter has made his defense. He and John and the lame man have stood up and given a very spirited defense. And now we talked about from Acts, I believe it's chapter 4, verse 15. Remember that word which was translated conferred? They have the apostles go outside, they confer among themselves. We looked at the word there, it's a compound word, and we said it meant to throw together. So they're trying to throw together an explanation. They're trying to come up with something to help them deal with the spread of the gospel. 4:17 says, but that it spread no further among the people, let us threaten them that they speak henceforth to no man in this name. This is the result from the private meeting that they had. The apostles, of course, had been put outside that. And what you have here really is an example of damage control. You sometimes hear those words applied today in the political realm or maybe another set of circumstances. Maybe it's a business. Bad news befalls the company or information that's damaging comes out to an individual and they want to control the damage. And there are firms out there, there are organizations which will help people try to do that. And that's what these fellows are trying to do as well. They knew that they couldn't stop what had happened. I mean, you heal the lame man. We've noted before, he had been lame from his mother's womb. He's been in that position for more than 40 years. And now the apostles are really making some progress. And that's not doing too good for their side. That would be the Jews and the Sanhedrin. So they want to stop the spread of the apostles' work among the people. Spread is found only here in the New Testament. It meant, in this case, spread a report. Today, how would the government respond to this kind of thing? They have information which is spreading about. They don't want it to happen anymore. Probably not in this country, but in some other countries. What's the government do? There's a news blackout. They just block the news. They might shut down the internet, or they might restrict the internet in some ways, and then they start controlling the TV. Maybe they already do that anyway. But they want to make sure that they control, as they say, the narrative. They want to control the flow of information. Well, in the first century, that's a little more difficult, isn't it? I mean, you can't pull the plug on the internet. There is none. Can't pull the plug on the TV, the radio. What are you going to do? I mean, people are accustomed to talking and sharing news that way. And even now, but in our day and time, they have to go back and start using some old school methods. But in that day and time, you're accustomed to sharing news, and that's a big part of the day because that's how you get your information. You talk to people. And now, you know, they've got to shut down that pipeline, so to speak, right?
You know, we see it around the world today. The government threatens the people, even in their speech and things. We know that some of the Christians have to hide out in different parts of the world even today because the government has threatened them.
And that's what we're dealing with here. They look at all the options, and we need to shut down that pipeline line of information. So let's go to the source. Let's look at the people who are talking about this stuff, and let's threaten them. Let's see if we can intimidate them into being silent. When you think about intimidation, when you think about threats, Ray mentioned that you have it today, maybe to a certain degree in our culture. It may be in a school system. If you have a prayer, if you have a Bible, if you know you're going to do this, that, or the other thing, we're going to try to intimidate you. We're going to try to threaten you. But if we back up a little bit in history, in the Bible, don't we have some threats, some intimidation? What about there in Exodus chapter 1? Remember, Pharaoh, babies, what happened? Tried to intimidate the women, right? If you have a male, what do? You better kill the child. And then as you move forward in biblical history, you have some other examples of intimidation. You think, for example, in the book of Daniel, you have some information over there as far as Daniel and his friends. They sought to intimidate them as well. Jesus, he was certainly someone that the people tried to intimidate. At times, a lot of people have tried to threaten individuals at times because that is a very, very powerful tool. Let's run a couple references here. At least we'll look at one. Philippians chapter 1, verse 28. Philippians 1, verse 28. All right, Ray's got it. Philippians 1, verse 28.
In no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them, but a salvation for you, and that too from God.
Is that 128?
Philippians 128.
Would you read that one more time?
Yes. That is the New American Standard.
Okay.
In no way alarmed by your opponents, which is a sign of destruction for them, but of salvation for you, and that too from God.
Okay, thank you. It threw me off a little bit. In no way be alarmed. In other words, don't be concerned about the threat. Don't be alarmed about the intimidation that you might experience. God is on your side, and that's certainly what we see when it comes to the apostles. Now, when you start thinking about the Sanhedrin, from one perspective, it seems kind of illogical as far as the choice that they made. I mean, you would think that, is this really the best that these guys can come up with? But when you look at it from another perspective, it really makes all the sense in the world. If you are this group, you are part of this religious hierarchy, and this structure is in place. And I mean, it's really integrated into society, and your job in life is to be part of that society. These guys come along, they start threatening your way of life. What choice do you have? Your choices are pretty restricted, aren't they?
Join in or oppose.
Pretty much, that's it. And you might hope that these guys will just go away, but that really hasn't worked out too well, has it? You know, you get rid of Jesus, and now, okay, you don't have him as far as a ringleader, but you've got this mushrooming. Now you have 12 significant helpers, 12 apostles, and that's not working out very, very well. So they committed themselves to this system, and unless they were going to recant, unless they were going to back up, it was going to be a very, very difficult problem for them. And they weren't willing to check out the scriptures and see whether or not the gospel that was being preached by the apostles was right. All right, so as you look at Acts 4, verse 17, that's where we are for those that are still joining us. Notice he says, but if they spread no further among the people, let us threaten them that they speak henceforth to how many people? No man in this name. Now that word no man literally means no man. It's like saying, you guys seal your lips. It's not that we want you to limit. We want you to reduce the number of people that you're talking to. Just have your prayer meetings on Sunday. I mean, it is shut this down. Don't talk about this anymore. Now, that's kind of hard for me to imagine in the culture that we live in, where somebody comes and says, don't breathe a word of this when it comes to a religious matter. Now, they might say, over here, don't talk about it. Or over there, don't broadcast it. But they're trying to put an absolute muzzle on the gospel of Christ. And there is, as we look through this, a very practical lesson there, but we'll hold off on that for just a little bit longer. It's the same term that was used by Luke in Acts 13, verse 28. There it says that there was no cause for Jesus to die. So when they say no man, as I said, that's trying to bring it to the point where no person whatsoever spoke. Now, as you think about the threat, and you find this hinted at in Acts chapter 4, but you can see enough of it here. Was there any kind of risk in trying to intimidate the apostles? Or today, is there some kind of risk when you try to threaten or intimidate somebody? Not in every case, but there can be. And what would sometimes the risk be? Well, okay, in our day and time, you're probably not facing that problem here. But yes, in our day and time, you try to intimidate somebody, they might sue you. What else?
Well, you risk antagonizing those who are their followers.
Yeah. And in this case, we'll see that in a few more verses, but in this case, the people were a little concerned. The Sanhedrin was mindful that they might stir up a mob. And that's going to create even more difficulties for them. And then, too, if you intimidate somebody, think of it in terms of maybe you're living in this community, somebody comes along and intimidates you. Yeah, you know, a person says, well, okay, we're just not going to stay here and take that. So what are we going to do? We're going to go somewhere else. Now, that might, had the apostles and the other Christians done that, that might have gotten the problem out of Jerusalem proper. But still, that probably isn't what they wanted. Because you send these guys packing, which is what you find in Acts chapter 8, you're still going to have overtones. There's still going to be the problem. Those people are still going to come back at times to Jerusalem. So that's not really a good option either. But out of all the choices that they had, none of them obviously good. Intimidation seems to have been the best choice. So that is what they wanted to do, right?
Last year about this time, our government was antagonizing the people out there in Oregon. And eventually one of those people did get killed. But that turns around and can be something that the government really didn't want to do, but it happened, so that may get other people very angry at the government. You can see the same thing here.
Yeah, you know, it's like poking the bear, as they say. You poke the bear in the eye with the stick. Now, that may not be literally true on too many occasions, but the point is, you go out and you start poking at people in one way or the other, intimidation, threats, and something's probably going to happen at some point. Now, that may not be the one who's doing the poking. It might be the one who's being poked, but still, at some point, you're generally going to get a response. And these fellows surely had enough wisdom to realize that, but maybe, you know, sometimes people, as they say, throw something against the wall and hope something will stick, and maybe they were thinking, well, maybe this will work. But in this case, they were very, very wrong.
Same thing here in the scripture.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
You see that in our culture today, whenever these moms gather to supposedly peaceful protest,
yeah,
they wind up throwing bricks and stones through windows and setting vehicles and buildings afire. And to them, that's okay, we're going to intimidate them,
yeah,
and they won't do this again because they don't want us to do this again. So, I mean, it's the same principle.
I'm going to develop some more of that, I think, as we get a little deeper into this, but you're exactly right. There are some great parallels between what we have in Acts chapter 4 and some of the things that are happening today. And you do find that with people. In fact, whichever side of the political spectrum you happen to be on, you do find people encouraging some form of intimidation. Now, they won't use that word. What's the word that they use? It's a B word. Not a girl, but a... What's the opposite of a girl? A boy. Oh, there you go. I thought I'd give you a couple clues. A boycott. And they don't say it's intimidation, but that's really what it is, isn't it? If you have a business that's making a decision or supporting something that you don't like, boycott the business. Now that, as I said, comes from both the right and it comes from the left, but that is a form where they're trying to encourage people to change their behavior or do something differently, and they're using the pocketbook, the bottom line, as an incentive to get those changes made. So it's an old, old tactic. Sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it doesn't, as we see in Acts 4. Bonnie?
Well, what about the threats that we've heard about trying to silence preachers from teaching the truth about homosexuality?
Yeah.
Weren't there threats about...
There's been some concern about that, especially in the country of Canada. We'll see what happens with that, but you're right. Christians in general, there have been times where people have tried to bully, to intimidate, to, you know, back them into a corner and try to silence them. And I think there's a reason for that. This wasn't me. Actually, I picked this up. I didn't know about this until a couple of days ago, but there's been, going back to Trump for just a second, some of the stuff that's taken place. A Baptist preacher, I think from down south, he sounds like he's a very bright guy, quick talker. He apparently was with Trump for a long time, told Trump early on that he was going to win and so forth, and he had some kind of private time with Trump where he gave Trump his own little personal sermon. Now, I obviously would not agree with some of the theological positions that guy has, but I do think that he did a couple of things which were really noteworthy. Whether we're going to like Trump or not remains to be seen. Some people have already made up their minds they're not going to definitely like him. But anyway, this fellow went back and he said, hey, there's a fellow in the Bible way back when, and he reminds me of you. Now, if you didn't see that, you want to take a stab at who he compared Trump to?
Nehemiah.
Very good. Very good. Now, maybe you saw it, maybe not. I'm not going to ask you for that part of the question. But anyway, he went back and compared Trump to Nehemiah and said, hey, you know, this guy was a builder. He's building a wall, and guess what you want to do? And made some really interesting comparisons, and I thought that was kind of a fascinating thing that he did. But in that discussion, and this is what I was leading up to, he said, when you look at people who profess to be Christians, he said, they are like a roadblock in a society. And I thought you hit it exactly on the head. If you're going to have a religious country, and that country is going to lose its religious foundation, its religious fabric, who do you have to bulldoze? You've got to bulldoze the people who are holding to religious principles, and in general, that for our country would be the Christian faith. And his suggestion was, and I think that's exactly right, that's why you have, in many respects, such an assault on God, the Bible, and the Christian faith, because people know that until they can get rid of that, it's not a clear path. You know, you're always having to deal with this, and you're having to deal with that, but if you can take religion out of the public eye for the most part, you've got a clear path. There's clear sailing. And that was about the most succinct description that I've heard anybody give of that particular point. And that was one of the things that he tried to convey to President Trump. And I thought, well, again, the theology probably had several holes in it. I'm not sure if Trump listened very well. But at least for a national leader To hear that from somebody, I was grateful to let him know that religion needs to play a significant part in the fabric of a country. So to, you know, hopefully get us off on a good start, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But at least the president, in my mind, got some information that was correct, at least in that regard. So very, very significant. All right, anything else before we look at Acts 4, verse 18? Ray?
We have the same thing in, I don't know, the Senate or the Congress where they stop everything because one party just takes over the floor.
Exactly. Yes, we're going to try to bully, intimidate, we're going to get our way, we're going to block and use various procedural moves to make sure that we can stifle debate or maybe increase debate so something doesn't get looked at in a timely manner. So yes, I mean, it's used by people from all stripes, all walks of life, and these guys are doing it as well. All right, Acts 4, verse 8, and they, that would be the Sanhedrin, called them, that would be the apostles, and charged them not to speak at all nor to teach in the name of Jesus. So, as I said before, you can kind of take that and relate that to what I was talking about just a little bit ago. Let's get rid of this roadblock back in the first century and certainly now as well. And if we are silent, then, of course, society will see that they have a clear path to go and do exactly what they want. When Christians behave like Peter and John, the unsaved are often stirred to action, aren't they? You have people who stand up and say, we're going to be that roadblock. Now, you might be able to steamroll us. We might not be able to stop you, but we are going to put up opposition. There is a God, and he's given his will. There's some things that are morally wrong. There's some things that are morally right. There's something called sin. And if you have some people in society who stand up and start making those points, you think that's going to get a little attention? Uh-huh. And when you stand up and you make those points and somebody says, shut up and sit down, we don't like what you're saying. And you say, sorry, I can't do that. Do you think you're going to get some more attention? Oh, yeah. And that's what we have in Acts chapter 4. The word that's translated charged in 4:18 is used about 30 times in the New Testament. And you might describe it or give it this definition. Command, instruct, give orders, transmit. Now, it's very interesting that as you look at this word in Acts 4, verse 18, transmit, charge, order, command, one of the 30 or so places that it's used is later in Acts. It's used several times in Acts, and it's Acts 10, verse 42. I want you to, if you will, turn over there, and let's have somebody read that. Acts 10, verse 42. The Sanhedrin calls these guys, commands them, charges them, instructs them not to teach at all or preach in the name of Jesus. 10:42, same word, who's got it? Kitty? Okay. Okay, now this is Peter, household of Cornelius, about probably at least 7 or 8, maybe closer to 10 years later. Peter said what? We have been charged. We have been commanded. We've been instructed by whom?
God.
Christ. God. Now back here in Acts 4, what do we find? The Sanhedrin is commanding, instructing, charging. When you put those two passages together, and again, there is a span of time between the two, Peter had two very different charges, didn't he? Men are telling them to do this. Christ had told him to do this. Now, if you take Acts 10:42 and look at when the charge was given, obviously the charge that he's talking about in Acts 10 was given before the charge in Acts 4. Jesus gave that charge before he went back into heaven. So when you look at it from that perspective, the charge in Acts 4 and the charge that Peter's talking about in Acts chapter 10, they were not that far apart. Now, we often turn over in our minds and in our Bibles to Acts chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. In that next chapter, we remember those words Peter said, but we must obey God rather than man. And those verses are perfectly fine to use when we have that kind of discussion. But I want you to see from today what we have in Acts chapter 4, verse 18. You have a chapter before Acts 5. Really, that same information. Plus, when you know that word charge is used in Acts chapter 10, verse 42, it makes the point, I think, especially memorable. All right, the Sanhedrin commands Peter and John not to speak at all nor to teach in the name of Jesus. That word, which is translated speak, is used a couple times in the New Testament, and it was used by Greeks for any sort of sound or voice, whether of man or animal or inanimate object, as of thunder, musical instruments, etc. And it's one more way of telling these guys, when it comes to this subject, say how much? Zip. we want you to be absolutely silent about this. Do not breathe a word of it. And that command, if it were not specific enough, what else do the leaders go on to say? We don't want you to teach in the name of Jesus. The word teach is a fairly common verb in the New Testament. Sometimes it describes false teaching, but in this particular case, it seems to cover any type of religious discussion. So the apostles could have said, well, you know, we're not going to preach, but we're just going to have a Bible study off here in the temple in this side area. They weren't thinking that that would be allowed. I mean, they want to shut it down completely. And that happens sometimes. A person will come along and say, you can't talk about this, breathe a word of this, you'll be in trouble. Maybe it's a parent-child situation, whatever it might be. And that's really what the apostles were being told to do, to not do anything at all. I'm not sure about the wisdom of that. It might have been better for the Sanhedrin to have tried something a little less dramatic and say, well, you know, don't talk about it too much. But when they come to this point where they say, don't say a single word about it to anybody at any time in any place, and that's really what you have here as far as the gist of it, how worried were they? Or does that reflect worry?
The Sanhedrin,
worry on their part. I think that you have to say they were as concerned as they could possibly be, because they went to great lengths, great measures to try to shut this stuff down. And at this point, they probably couldn't have done any more. We'll deal with that in the later verses. But it was a huge issue. Anything that you want to add or ask before we continue in the text, Steve?
It just makes me think about in this day and age, there's more divisive ways, I should say. When I think about evolution and creation, you got the evolutionists who, if they can convince, and they're starting at a young age, if they can convince them that evolution is real, not creation, then they've taken God completely out of the equation. Mm-hmm. And they've got them to believe basically a lie and that there isn't God.
You see here, really, I think a good example as far as the example that you gave, and people in general, a good example of the inequality that you have when it comes to people who profess to be the Bible, profess to believe the Bible, and the people who are largely secular in their thinking. When you look at people who believe in the Bible, if you are of the persuasion correctly that God has given people free will, if somebody wants to believe in evolution, now we might talk to them about that. We might try to show that that is not where the evidence is. But ultimately, if a person wants to believe in evolution, the Christian position is what?
God gave you a choice.
Yeah. I mean, God lets people live in sin if they want, doesn't he? I mean, he doesn't come down and say, well, I'm not going to let you have that sin. You want it. Okay, that God says, I don't want that. That's not my preference. That's going to be a bad end for you. But if you want to use your free will in that way, you have that right. If we're following God's will, we allow people to do that. But when you look at the people who would be on the other side of the fence, what's their thinking when it comes to free will? Now, it's not true across the board, but many of them are exactly like Steve described, right? When it comes to evolution in the classroom, there's no room for debate. I mean, this is it. This is the gospel. This is the law. This is what you need to believe. This is what you need to teach.
You don't want to free will if you believe what I
believe. Exactly. Then you get the A. I had, and this is probably not the best example, but this is a true example. I guess I've always been a little bit of a rebel at heart. But when I was in probably the 8th or 9th grade, I had a teacher who was a feminist. Now, at that time, I didn't know what a feminist was. I just knew that she favored girls. And I mean, she was always talking about girl power and women's rights. And you know, that was new to me. But every class, she was into the, you know, ERA, if you remember that back in the probably 70s is when the heyday for that was. And when it came time to do a paper in her class, I don't remember doing too many papers in high school, but she had us do a paper. And, you know, the paper would have been along the lines of women's rights. I thought I wrote a really good paper. My grade was no higher than a B. There were some girls who wrote papers, and I don't think that they were nearly as good as mine, and they got A's. So again, in her class, it was, if you follow my teaching, my beliefs, my doctrine, you're going to do well. You're going to be a cherished pupil. If you don't, if you're contrary like Brad, you're going to take the hit. Well, I was willing to take the hit and get the lower grade because some of the stuff that she was spouting just didn't make a lot of sense to me. But again, you get back to that, and they're not so charitable. they really can't stand debate. And when you get into an academic setting such as college or university, even more so. Anybody else? All right, let's pick up then with what we have in Acts chapter 4, looking now at verses 19 and 20. Verse 19 says, "But Peter and John answered and said unto them, Whether it is right in the sight of God to hearken unto you rather than unto God, judge ye. For we cannot but speak the things which we saw and heard." We've noted the command to be completely silent about the gospel, verse 18. And as you look back a little bit, back in Acts chapter 4, verse 13, you find that the Sanhedrin, as they looked at Peter and John, they said, these guys are bold. They are not from the kind of background that we are. They were from a fishing background, Peter and John, and yet they were very bold in their presentation of the gospel. They made that great defense as we studied from verses 8 through 12, and here we see that they're not going to change their minds. They were not willing to change their minds about the truth. And you have here two different groups, two different philosophies, if you will, and Peter's already laid out the truth of the gospel, so now he comes out with these words. He says, whether it's right in the sight of God to hearken unto you, the Sanhedrin, instead of God, judge ye. Now, a couple quick points here as far as finer points from the text, and then we'll stop and make some observations that I alluded to earlier. That word which is translated right in verse 19 not only means right, but it means required of God. Now, think about that. Talking about what's required of God. If you're interested in God, if you're interested in spiritual things, and you know that this is what God requires, that should get your attention. And that certainly had been on the minds of Peter and John. So as Peter uses that word, he's essentially asking, does God require us to listen to you or listen to him? And that's one more reason why I say, even though we turn to Acts 5, 28 and 29, nothing wrong with that. You really have that same information back here in Acts chapter 4 as well. So if you never put that together with Acts chapter 5, that might be something that you want to bear in mind. It's really a stinging rebuke on the part of the apostles, especially Peter. When you look at the adverb, which is translated rather, that's in the ASV or more in the King James translation, it's really a direct comparison between the leaders and God. You guys are here, God's over here, and we have to make a choice. Which one do you think we should choose? Well, that obviously didn't help their case as far as trying to curry favor with the judge. The reference to the word judge is also significant. One source said that Peter's response was defiant. I like that description. He said, you members of the Sanhedrin are judges. Judge this one. Now you can all, it's kind of like, ouch. You know, this is your area. Here are the facts. You guys make a decision. So Peter got a little testy with him. But again, he's inspired. So, really put him on the toes. And I think that's a great point because Peter was inspired, but inspiration didn't override some personal characteristics. And when you look at Peter, what do you see about his nature?
He's bold.
Yeah, that's being kind. That's being kind. He could really get worked up sometimes, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. And you can imagine, you got the Sanhedrin out there, and they've said all this stuff, and now they're bringing in, they're trying to intimidate you. You know, I imagine that Peter might have seen red. And, he makes... Because when he expresses this, he says, you guys judge, he uses the imperative mood. And one of the things that we know about the imperative mood is that it is a command. You guys judge it. And you can almost see him out there, maybe even shaking his fist. So it was a good moment for him, but maybe when he got back home, he reflected on that in a bit and thought, it may not have been my finest moment. I might have tempered that a little bit.
Peter, no, I meant the Sanhedrin listening to him.
They might have as well. You would hope that at least some of them had asked that question. Yeah. I wonder if Peter might have wondered, too, a little bit later, should I have been, maybe a little less direct here or there? But
he was told he'd be speaking what the Spirit put into his thoughts, and he didn't want to be the
Mm-hmm. It happens sometimes, I know, with preachers. For example, a person may hear a sermon, and when the information is delivered, it sort of sits in the head, but afterwards they got to lunch, or maybe a few days later, it's kind of like, So you would hope that with the Sanhedrin, now, you look a little bit later, and yeah, it didn't still sit so well with them after a time. And then two, going back to Peter for just a second, if you've ever had the experience where you've said something to somebody, and then later you thought about what you said, and you asked yourself the question, did I really say that? I have no difficulty believing that not just with Peter, but maybe especially with him, that there were some times where maybe that came up as well. You know, really? I was before the Sanhedrin? I mean, he knew what Jesus had said. You're going to appear before kings and other people. But I was just before the Jewish Supreme Court, and that's what I said. You guys are judges. You judge this and the other stuff. I mean, you know, he's handing it back to him big time.
Well, relative to that, sometimes you get in a situation that's impossible, and you might have been, your feelings were such and such up to that point. Maybe you're tense, maybe you're angry, maybe whatever. And then the realization hits you that this is an impossible situation. I'm not going to get anywhere, anyway. And all of that feeling just goes away, and then you just start talking. And Peter might have reached that point at which, hey, this is impossible. And then he just said what was on his mind. Yes, later on, he might have said, wow, did I really do that?
It was amazing. I don't know if any of you with the inauguration and the people who are in Washington right now had a chance to look at some people who were not so enthused about President Trump becoming the next president. But I saw a little of this a few days ago, very early this morning. I happened to watch a little bit of C-SPAN. I rarely watch C-SPAN, but because of what's happened over the last few days, I did tune in for a little bit. And there were some ladies. It was the Women's March on Washington. So if you didn't see any of that, there were several speakers. Obviously, all the ones that I saw were ladies. They may have had some males up there at some point, but I think there's probably not a big chance of that, or they were very few and probably short-lived as far as the amount of time that they would have spoken. But as I look at Acts chapter 4, and this takes us back to what we were talking about earlier, you have here two very different views, and neither one is willing to budge. As we talked about the fact the Jewish people, they had their hierarchy. They're part of that. And they're not willing to back up. And then you have on the other side, you have Peter and the apostles. And as you look at what we have here, what do they say? We've got to speak. That's present tense. Verse 20. We cannot but speak. We're compelled to speak, present tense. Because of what? We have seen and we have heard things. And we know this to be right. This is our absolute conviction. We're willing to die for this. So they're on this side, they're on this side, and they may not be shouting at each other like I saw with the ladies who were speaking at that march, but, you know, they're at loggerheads. There is just no give and take there. And that's going to be a problem. Now, putting that into our day and time, if you were to look at some of that information, you've got some people as far as the rhetoric and as far as the people out there shaking their fists and holding up the signs and so forth, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in our country over the next 4 years. Now, maybe there's going to be some give and take on one side or the other. We'll see whether or not that happens. But if there's not, what do we learn from Acts chapter 4? Well, we're going to suffer in America with some huge headaches. Somebody's going to come out the loser. And how that works out, I don't know. But when you have people who are this opposed to one another, and the opposition that I saw this morning was to the point, you know, I'm all for emphatic speakers. And if you're dealing with a crowd of, you know, at least a few thousand, oh yeah, we're glad that you're here this morning, that's probably not going to cut it if you're going to be an effective speaker out there. But, I mean, these speakers were really trying to whip people up into a frenzy, which in that kind of environment, if it's a political setting, you would expect that regardless of what political position is being advanced. But like I say, when we think about our country, where we are right now, if you've not been in the habit of praying for our country, it's a good time to begin, because we just have reached a point now where there are so many forces, some of them religious, some of them political, some of them secular. I mean, unless something gets straightened out sooner rather than later and people are somehow brought together in some fashion, we're going to be torn apart. Now, that isn't said because I'm a prophet, but that's said because of what Jesus taught. Remember, a house divided against itself can't stand, Matthew chapter 12. And that's right. Lincoln quoted those words many years ago. Jesus was exactly right. So for the short term, America may hang together reasonably well for a long time. But, you know, regardless of where people are in the political realm, we're in trouble. And the only thing that I can see that will bring us back together is God. But there are a lot of forces out there right now that are simply not interested in that. But even though they're not interested, our job is to be like the apostles and say, well, there's some things that we know. There's some things that we're convicted of, and we're going to stand up and speak. We might not be much of a speed bump. We might not be much of a roadblock. But, you know, the idea that we're just going to lay down and you can steamroll over us, not happening.
Did you notice an age group that were the biggest protesters, though?
Say that again.
Age group.
Okay, were you asking me? I wanted to make sure that was a question as far as... Yeah.
So I was wondering in the women's lib thing, did you see that in the audience as well? The younger.
Yeah, when they're panning the crowd, you never want to be too definitive as far as drawing some conclusions. But based on what I saw, I'm going to put them in the 25 to 35
right.
group.
I agree.
You know. Now, you might have some people who felt that way that were senior citizens or maybe in the 50s and 60s and they didn't feel like that, you know, they had the time or inclination to come out. Because oftentimes when you have a protest, regardless of who's doing what, you know, whether it's PETA or whether it's politics or religious, a lot of times you're going to find the younger folks. You know, maybe they are easier to rile in the younger years, whatever that might be. So the age in and of itself, I don't know that I would put too much in that, but... that would be where I would put the most.
Like the millennials.
Yeah, I would say pretty much that. But when you look at the millennials, Steve and I don't know if he's here this morning or not, didn't see him. There he is, okay. But we were talking about that last night. When you deal with the millennials, we're dealing with really a generation that's unlike anything that we've ever seen for a lot of reasons. And one of the big things with them would be social justice. We're not going to get into that big time. But that was one of the things there that was a theme, you know, social justice. And once people get their backs up, it's very, very difficult to communicate with them. And as we're talking to people about the gospel, that's one of the problems that we have sometimes trying to understand that generation. They're not going to be taught. They're not going to be reached in some of the ways that we've tried to reach people before. We can talk about facts all day long, but until you start dealing with some other things like authority and is there a standard for right and wrong, a God? You know, you're probably not going to make a lot of progress.
I didn't watch it a whole lot. I would say maybe a most of 30 minutes. But when I was watching it, there was a segment where there was a whole lot of generational women. Women my age, my daughter, my granddaughter there. And I think those older women are still a big sparking point
yeah.
to keep the fire going for the generations down. And maybe, you know, maybe they're, I don't know what the numbers were, but say there was 1,000 of these old ladies and then 2,000 of, like, my Jenny, and then
right.
so forth, and it keeps spreading out, you know. I think those old ladies are doing a great job of keeping this fire burning.
Yeah, they are. You've got some of the old guard that are... that have been around long enough to really stir the pot, and then you've got the younger energy. And that's, you know, but again, that's how it works. If you're going to follow God's plan and have future generations teach the gospel, what do? 2 Timothy 2:2. Train others also, teach others also, hand it off, and that's what they're trying to do. So it's a biblical strategy, and it's being used very effectively by some people who have some very different beliefs. And that's why I say, as you see that mounting and mounting and mounting, you have that opposition over here, and they're entrenched in their position. And then you have people with other beliefs over here, and then you toss in the Muslims. They're a definite part. And then you toss in the people who are from the progressive secular side of things. They hate God. They hate religion. And you've got at least four forces that are doing all that they possibly can to, you know, get their way. And at some point, somebody, most people lose, and maybe everybody loses. So we are in my estimation, a very, very difficult and in some respects dangerous time. You know, there was somebody that was a celebrity the other day. They laughed it off, but they said, well, we should just go up, blow up the White House. Was that who it was? I didn't get a name attached to it, but I just thought, you know, people are, you know, don't say that kind of stuff because who knows who's listening. And, you know, so like I say, we're just in a time that is really unbelievable. I'm going to make one other quick point here, and then if there's something that you want to say in the last minute or two, that'll be fine as well. When you look at the apostles and their interaction with the Sanhedrin, now the Sanhedrin, of course, was the Jewish high court for all intents and purposes, but they also, in some respects, were like a political authority. And as you look here, you have maybe not the only passage that you would want to turn to, but you have here, in many respects, what I would think of as church and government together. And you have here the government, the Sanhedrin, telling the church, this is what to do. This is how you need to act. Well, when that came up, what did an inspired apostle do? No. We know that you have authority. We recognize the authority. But you're going to have to judge. What's right? Do we obey you, the secular authority, or do we obey God? And that's the same message in Acts chapter 5. So there is a separation. God did intend for a separation. We have that separation exemplified, and it's a separation that we might find that it becomes more important as we move forward in the history of our nation. Anybody want to add a closing thought or two? Ray?
Well,